Go Loud. AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.
Hello and welcome to this special bonus episode of AI Magnified Plus, brought to you by Fitzgerald Power. Hopefully by this stage you'll have listened to at least one, hopefully all four of the previous episodes where we did an examination of where AI is bringing us all, bringing society, bringing business, the people involved in it. We've had a fantastic reaction to it and we're delighted that we did the series. And if you've missed any of it, please do go and have a listen. But what we've got to you today as a bonus is the special conference that was hosted by AIB in association with Fitzgerald Power, in which we put together a new panel of speakers and I pitched questions to them, and then we had some much better questions coming from the audience that was present with us at the live event looking at further issues in relation to AI. So we're not repeating what we've done in the first four episodes. We've got whole new perspectives and takes and experiences to listen to. It was a really enjoyable event and we have the podcast of it for you to enjoy now, so please do. And I'm delighted that this series is proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power, a firm that thrives on creating the best accountancy service to its clients using technology, industry insights and innovative solutions. Fitzgerald Power helps businesses unlock their full potential and make more informed decisions. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to ask each of our panel members to join us on stage now. If they wouldn't mind, please taking their seats, because what we're going to do is we're going to, as we record this for the fifth episode of this AI Magnified series, we're going to hear their perspectives on leveraging AI to drive innovation, improve efficiency and enhance decision making within SMEs. So we are focusing on your suggested topics and you are going to be invited to give your thoughts on how your clients and customers are actively integrating AI into their businesses. And we're going to get advice and tips that they're going to share along the way. We're going to give you the opportunity. You may not have had any questions for Brona there, but I'm going to insist on questions a little bit later from you to the panel. So please bring them to us. So as I said, this panel discussion is being recorded and released as a bonus episode of the AI Magnified podcast series. And there's also going to be video footage taken on the day here today that will be shared across social media. So let me introduce our various guests. Stuart Fitzgerald is Chief Executive of Fitzgerald Power, which is a firm focused on accountancy services with a commitment to empowering businesses with deeper financial insights, helping them make strategic, informed decisions. And as an established leader, he can provide insights into how AI is impacting traditional industries such as accounting and finance and share practical steps for other businesses to begin integrating AI. Tariq Zaki is CTO of Shopbox AI, which is an AI-driven e-commerce solution focused on customer experience and personalization. He has a deep understanding of the retail sector and he's going to offer us insights into how AI is revolutionizing customer engagement and sales processes. Jane Tolan is head of AI at AIB, responsible for designing and implementation of an AI strategy within a major financial institution. And she's going to bring us her perspective on how AI can support transformation in large-scale regulated industries. Pekovic is the head of product design at Nori, and he designed a hospitality OS that helps its users make better business decisions every day. He was previously lead product designer at Glowfox, a B2B SaaS serving the fitness industry worldwide, and head of design at Kuhaba, an award-winning digital agency in Dublin and Berlin. And finally, Michael Corcoran is co-founder of Frankly, a social media agency. He has extensive experience in digital and social media, places like Paddy Power and Ryanair, and he's going to share his insights on how AI is transforming customer interactions and marketing. So there you are. Those are our five panelists. Stuart, I'm going to start with you because you're looking at this both from your own business point of view, I presume, but also all of your various clients and what sort of advice and mentoring you're going to have to give them. So where are you in this evolution of AI for finance and accounting?
Lots of the gains that we've made have been around content creation. So using ChatGPT, et cetera, or using the likes of Copilot, the Microsoft application to take notes of meetings. But I think from a finance perspective, there's been a huge amount of automation over the last 10 years or so. Not much of it has come from AI yet. So we're very much trying to understand, and the series has been great, by the way, in terms of building out our understanding of what's happening. But I think we're all of us who are running small businesses are all very much grappling with what does AI mean? I met a client on the way in who said to me, Stuart, I'm looking forward to AI replacing you in the next 6 months. But Justin, if you're still here, news of my demise is greatly exaggerated.
Do you have that fear, though, that there are people who think that particularly in services that are provided, that they'll see AI as a way of replacing those services?
I don't think so. I think it's like co-intelligence. So I think, you know, Microsoft Office, Microsoft Excel came out in 1985. I think if the industry had thought in 1985 about the waves of innovation that would have swept through and how different the industry would look and how much work people could get through, the quality, the richness of the data, the quality of the service, the speed of the service, how all of that would have improved, I think we would have been blown away. And we haven't lost. I mean, I think Fergal O'Rourke on this week's podcast was talking about his early days in Pricewaterhouse. And I think the industry is fundamentally different, but the industry is grappling, Matt, with a resourcing issue. So it's not a case that I see technology replacing jobs. I think it's going to make maybe finance more fulfilling, and it's going to help people to do better work, and it's maybe going to help to attract and retain people because...
In a strange way, will it perhaps reduce the amount of drudgery that might have been involved, if that's not too strong an expression, but allow you to, in many respects, be more creative, to use your own human brain power?
Absolutely. I think without the human insight, the service just doesn't work. So I think the industry has been grappling, my industry has been grappling with relevance, with attracting talent, with retaining talent. There's so many options out there now for ambitious, intelligent, hungry young grads, and accountancy, audit and finance isn't as appealing as it once was. So I think absolutely, you're 100% correct. Taking a lot of the drudgery out of the job, automating a lot of the tasks that aren't added value, and allowing people to really creatively bring solutions to clients, I think is the future. So I see this wave of technological expansion as only helping to reinforce the quality and the speed of the service that's delivered to clients, and helping to, I suppose, create jobs and retain jobs.
Jane, what would your position on all of that be, given you're in financial services as well?
Yeah, no, I completely agree that I think this is about potentially automating tasks that aren't value add for employees and helping them be more productive and freeing up their time to do more value add work. I think someone recently gave the example of, you know, ATMs came out and the fear that they'd replace tellers, and, you know, those teller jobs just evolve and the jobs in the branches evolve. And I think this is something that we need to think about similarly. I also think the potential to upskill for people, change roles is huge, and we're actually creating jobs in AIB from an AI perspective. So we have an AI Centre of Excellence being established. So I think I'd really like people to not have that fear and look to embrace the technology.
How receptive is AIB when customers come along saying, I need money to invest in AI?
Well, I am not in that part of the business. That's a question for Alan. So I'll leave that to capital markets.
And who will make the decision, the credit scoring decision? Will it be humans or will it be AI?
Well, we already have, you know, kind of machine learning model support in credit decisioning and credit models in part of the bank. And we have done for a long time. And I think there probably isn't a bank on the planet who hasn't. So it's about understanding that and educating people around that, I think.
Michael, I want to bring you in because you were a guest previously on my Magnified podcast. And for those of you not familiar
for your sins.
For those of you not familiar with the podcast series, the AI podcast series has come from an interview series with people across all ranges of interests and professions and backgrounds. And Michael was absolutely fascinating in what he told us about his business career. And I actually hadn't thought of you, because you use your own imagination brilliantly for social media campaigns, that you're an enthusiastic user of AI. Why so?
Before I touch on, I think 2 points with the guys is like, evolution, I think, is the big takeaway from what everyone said, but also there has to be a reality, like, take print media, like content creation, like broadcast. You're going to see certain businesses fall away. That is a reality because they won't exist anymore. And I'll give you an example. For years, marketing communications have been relying on market research companies to provide insight, collate insight, mine insight to give you so you can start making strategic decisions on marketing, on creative. You're going to see a lot of those businesses fall out of the industry because AI can literally go out to anywhere with what exists with information, pull it within minutes and give you exactly what you need that those businesses have been providing for a long period of time. So evolution is going to happen. There is a reality. Businesses will change, but it will create new jobs and new jobs will evolve. So I would be a very realist on that situation. When it comes to marketing communications, that is the first example. It makes the mundane tasks easier for creative individuals. No matter what touch point you're at, mining research, identifying an insight that you can then find some way to creatively connect with people through marketing communications, it becomes incredibly handy. So from sourcing and the starting point of ideas, it allows us to be faster, which means we can spend more time on being more creative and invest the time in creativity and not actually trying to find that sweet spot or nugget or that rich insight that we can connect with maybe a brand purpose that or a brand, you know, value that we want to then creatively express that through content or through marketing or things like that. But then there's the creation side as well. And that's where it gets even more fun, because for small businesses, the struggle to compete with bigger businesses in the world of social media means content production is a time and a financial investment, but it allows us to be more creative and faster. Like you see a lot of brands who do have limited budget and do have limited resource where they're trying to create marketing campaigns either organically, unpaid or with paid media, and they don't have the budget to hire models to do big production shoots. So they rely on stock imagery and stock videos to make their creative. But even that is flat and it's quite clinical and it's quite overused because it's from the same libraries and the same files that everybody is using. So when you hear jingles on a piece of content, you almost start to hear, oh, I've heard that track before because that other brand has used it. When I even hear ads on the radio, I can tell what library that is from because content is so overused. The beauty about AI, it's going to give small businesses who are lean with budget more flexibility to make their creative better. Examples being, you go to Getty Images to use a stock piece of imagery for a marketing campaign, but it's limited. You find the right person, but they might have a book in their hand. Will you bring that through something like Adobe, which is an editing tool, or even CapCut, or there's even new apps to make design so much easier, like Canva. And you literally type in a prompt and go, change that book to my bottle of wine. Done. It just gives so much creative flexibility to make your work a little bit more personalized and better, especially for leaner businesses. Like AI, the great thing is it's hitting you at every touch point of the process, whether it's developing your product, which probably more experienced people here will lean on, but actually marketing, communicating, it's completely transforming people and it's great. Now, people are going to still use it and it's going to be quite flat. Because a lot of what it represents is existing content that is out there within the digital world. So it's still going to have a certain level of flatness. We'll go back to your early point. The tools speed up the process, which means you can be more creative. So when it comes to our industry, what AI is going to give the value for us is the most creative people are going to prosper. The most mundane and people who relied on, you know, average marketing, they're going to struggle in how they're going to push forward. The tools are going to make their life easier, but the most creative people are going to win.
Michael, you just used an example there, which suddenly gives me the ethical chills, perhaps. Mm. You manipulated a photograph and you removed a book from it and replaced it with a bottle of wine. Mm. So I come from a background, you know, where, you know, picture tells story a thousand words.
I thought you were going to say you drink a lot of wine, but...
Not anymore. Anyway, but you understand the issues that people have there with the ethical manipulation of images, because, okay, you might say that's innocent enough in that it was a picture for a specific purpose that you've adapted for another purpose for which, but there could be times when things are adapted for unethical purposes.
There will be times when it will be adapted for unethical purposes. And like all tools and all products and all evolution and all new things, there will be people who will take it and do silly things with it. So I don't think we can avoid that happening. However, the tools and the softwares are trying to already put safeguards in place to try and protect that. Like, take again, we mentioned Adobe. Adobe, if there's a generative AI change, which is again changing a book into a bottle of wine or putting a sun in the background or changing the color of the sky, within its metadata, which is the coding or the language behind the visual, will let people know that that has been adapted for the purposes of AI. I imagine social media platforms and all the rest are doing the same. Instagram, for example, if they're monitoring tools spot something that is, again, reading that data and says it has been adapted for the purpose of AI, it will flag that. So as with everything, they will try and evolve and put those safeguards in place, but you're never going to be able to protect people from making those changes and doing those silly things. And more importantly, with us and our attention span scrolling social media so fast, taking it literally without fact-checking ourselves. So I think that's the same from even before AI existed, before any tools, people have been photoshopping and writing headlines and spreading misinformation, fake news, because you can, and people will do that.
Igor, tell us a little bit, please, about what Nori does.
Sure. Well, basically, we've built an operating system for hospitality, as you said in the introduction. What is it? I'm going to start with what we care about and what we consider our North Star. And that is a restaurant's operating profit, right? Which we know that is razor thin. So we've built the product to try and impact that particular metric for restaurants. And the product comprises workforce inventory management, as well as a suite of business insights. I suppose this is the time when, this is the point at which I go into AI and how AI helps. There were some really, really good examples given here by the other speakers about helping with mundane tasks. So I'm going to take inventory management, for instance, and a restaurant manager who got into the hospitality game because they love creating experiences and they love serving people. And suddenly, to manage their inventory, they have to make sure they document all the invoices for all the deliveries they get throughout the day, right? We offer a functionality where that manager, rather than mark up that invoice and worry about storing it somewhere and not losing it, they simply take a photo of that invoice. Nori, using various AI algorithms, reads what's on that invoice, matches it up to the items in the inventory, and inputs that stock into the system so that we know and our users know exactly what they have in stock at any given time in the restaurant, right? And there is here's the thing. A lot hinges on the quality of the picture taken. So imagine the manager having to spend 5 minutes to take a perfect picture of a piece of paper. They don't have to do it because there is, in that tiny little minute action, there's AI that spends a few seconds recognizing, all right, that looks like a picture. That is a picture of a piece of paper. That looks like the angle is wrong. Let me manipulate that photo so that it can be scanned quickly and accurately. So for me, it's such a tiny example, right? And it's hard to draw a line between that and a restaurant's operating profit. But it's also a mundane, non-core task that has to be performed, right? Somebody has to keep track of the inventory that goes into the restaurant. Somebody has to keep track of the fact that, I don't know, a delivery was actually shorted and get that refunded from the supplier. We help there.
Because at the moment, restaurants are struggling. As we know, so many are closing. Many of them are saying that particularly it's the cost of things like food and alcohol and drinks that they bring in has increased, and they can't recover that in increased prices. So are you suggesting that they can recover some of their costs by better management of the inventory?
Yes, yes. And that is a really, really good example for another thing we do. So because we keep track of the stock in the restaurant, and we also keep track of sales in that restaurant, we know what ingredients are being used when. That's just historical data. There's no AI as such at play there. Where AI comes into play is, however, the next time the manager places an order, based on historical usage and our forecasts that AI generates, we tell them, hey, you can actually order less of this particular ingredient because our patterns show you're not going to use it all. So we prevent overstocking, we prevent waste, and we lower
So you could very easily, I'd imagine, work out on the course of a day how many particular items or how many people order a particular meal, and then that can be applied to how much stock you actually purchase.
Yes.
Because you can average out what's likely to be purchased on a particular day.
Yes, yes, yes. So, like, I really love spending time with our customers. And I've seen when we were developing that particular feature that was predicting, helping predict orders, we call it demand-based ordering. When we were developing demand-based ordering, I visited plenty of restaurants with an early testable version of the feature. And it was fantastic to see restaurant managers saying, oh, I'm going to order five of these because I always order five of these. And me asking them really, really gently, nudging them, maybe let's check how much you have in stock and how much you have to order. Trying to test the accuracy of the feature we're about to roll out, obviously. Go to the back, notice, oh no, I actually have enough. I only need two of these items. Look at the prediction. Yeah, Nori was recommending two. So there's definitely, you know, the human check is needed, but I think we can really help optimize the cost, drive down costs.
Tarek, tell us a little bit about what Shopbox AI does.
Yeah, so basically the kind of goal of Shopbox when I set it up with my co-founder was we were trying to create a personalized experience on any e-commerce store, kind of akin to what Amazon do. So like with the hyper-personalization, and Amazon are obviously probably the best in the world at it in terms of that. But when you're trying to build those kind of personalized experiences for the smaller retailers, you can't do exactly what Amazon do. Because Amazon have like these vast quantities of data. The minute they put a product live, they'll have millions of views and millions of interactions. And probably more so than most small retailers would have across their entire stock. So when we started to build our kind of AI models, we kind of looked at a kind of product first approach. So taking the product descriptions, which are actually really strong nowadays because of the search and SEO requirements and all that kind of stuff. And we kind of would use AI if there was some issues with descriptions. And we kind of build up an understanding of the products. So it's not like it's a Gucci handbag. It is a white leather, high value, high brand, 2 liter, I don't know if it's 2 liter bags for Gucci, bag. And we do that across the entire, so that's our starting point, and we get an understanding of how those relate to each other and how they interact with each other. We then build lots of, I won't go into like very, very strong detail, but we build lots of views like that for user interactions, for product views, for orders across the entire base. We then take that and kind of put that into our models. And what we're trying to achieve is, with this low volume and low amount of interaction data, order data, is how can you bring out the right product for the right person at the right time? Most models would tend to bring out the top sellers, which we're not trying to do that. We're trying to bring out the right product at the right time. So then you put our components on an e-commerce store, and it's no code. It's drag and drop. You drop it into your homepage. You can create the Amazon style new products, promotions. You can go on your product details pages and put your frequently bought together, or you may also like, and even on your category pages. So if I go into a pet shop today, a pet shop is actually one of our customers, and you look at dog food. From that one interaction, our system is able to tell an awful lot about that user. So they have a dog, I hope. Funny story about that, but I won't get into that now. We know the size of the dog based on the type of food, the age of the dog. So we can tell an awful lot about that user straight away. That means from that one interaction, we can actually start to manipulate the entire store around them. So new products for you will be based on what they're interacting with, and it will adjust kind of instantaneously. It doesn't have to wait the next day to build more models and stuff like that. So it's very much reactive and interactive within the moment. And then if you go into a category page, like you're looking at travel accessories, for instance, for your pets, we'll have a recommender on there that understands the context of the page you're on, that is not just looking at, it understands you're looking for travel accessories, but understands you as a user, you're looking at dogs. You're looking for dogs. It's not going to show you a cat carrier. In the same way, our systems are trying to understand the problems that people are trying to solve. So I have kids, so I'll probably go into a pharmacy site and I'll look for Calpol. And what you'll see a lot of recommender engines do is just present more Calpol, or maybe Nurofen, because that's kind of what's bought with them. But actually, if you're one of the problem that the person's trying to solve is they have a sick child, they're trying to make them feel a bit better. So what can we give them to do that? And it's not just Calpol. Some of the larger pharmacies will have their own brand versions of these things. They'll be cheaper for the customer to buy, which is better, and it solves their issue. So it solves the problem, what they're trying to achieve, but also the higher margin for the retailer. So it's trying to make this kind of win-win situation for with the personalization for the users and the retailers alike.
So where does AI fit in all of this in the models that you've developed?
So we're basically building the AI models to adjust in real time to what the users are interacting with. So we'll take the interaction data, the products data, to understand how things interact and integrate with each other. So for instance, we'll take cross-sell is obviously a big thing. Frequently bought together items are obviously quite big, and it's quite hard to do that with low volumes of data. So when we're looking at frequently bought together items, we'll look at what types of items are bought with other items. And the model around that will look at, so you're looking at this particular type of item, we'll break it down, and we go, we know this item, even though there's no purchase history with it, we know these items are tend to be bought with these other types of items. So we can create these kind of interactions between products that you would not normally see through maybe interactive data or order history.
Okay. How is this going to develop, you think, for retailing?
So we're talking short term or long term? So
both.
Yeah. So short term, like the personalization is obviously becoming a big thing, and being able to apply this to your store in a quick and easy manner is huge. So like we've actually released a Shopify app now, which you can basically implement all the kind of Amazon style personalization experience probably within a few minutes. So you'll see AI kind of speed up the rate you're able to do these kind of items. If you're looking at long-term, I think the way retail is moving is it, and the way we shop nowadays is going to change quite drastically. It's more about experiences, I think, more than anything now, because shopping online, it's not very social. And you're trying to grab people's attention and help them buy. So you want to maybe create better experiences, which can also create this kind of brand loyalty for people to come back to your shop. But you have the likes of TikTok Shop now coming on for the younger generation. And that's very interesting, where there's lots of opportunity there in how you can cross-sell items for people when they're in that TikTok Shop experience, or also like price optimization. So if you're showing something to somebody in maybe Ireland, you might charge them €20, but then in another country, you know that they're more price sensitive, you might actually drop it. But then the really interesting area for me is actually Roblox. Because the young generation coming back beyond TikTok are starting to use Roblox, and it's a huge experience platform. But people are actually starting to put retail and stores actually on the system. So Walmart have a store that you can purchase items through. And it's how do you actually, and we build our systems in this way that like there's an opportunity there where you can try to build an entire supermarket around a customer. So based on their, you know, price sensitivity, you know, the right shops you could present them and create better experiences for people in those environments. But like even in Roblox, they have an IKEA store now. You can actually get a job virtually and get paid minimum wage in Ireland, which is incredible.
So each time you mention Roblox, both Igor and Michael are nodding away almost enthusiastically. Igor, why?
I've never played Roblox. But I am seeing parallels to this whole thing around virtual reality and natural progression into that. Perhaps we're not there when it comes to our artificial representations in some form of VR, but people are finding ways using existing tools and applications. I find it really interesting.
Michael?
For me, the first one is when my children are on it. So I'm like, I understand it a bit more. And the beauty of actually having young kids, being a millennial, is we've skipped the Gen Z generation to know what's coming next and learn about it even faster. So for my career, it's actually brilliant. But funnily enough, Ryanair is on Roblox, but not Ryanair the brand. And this is why I find for this space so fascinating for the future world of what social media is or community. There was a group of teenagers who built Ryanair, the airline, on Roblox. They built the planes, the airports, the staff. There is a CEO version of Michael O'Leary.
Oh, God, Roblox,
equally as vocal and controversial. I won't degrade any bankers here. Like, again, teachers was one thing, but I definitely won't do bankers because I need to talk to you lovely people. But they built an airline where, to the point that was made, was you could sign up, you could join the airline as a CEO, a marketing director, a pilot, cabin crew, engineers, and actually run an air and operate an airline within this world. So much so that they made their maiden flight about 2 years ago, where they flew their first plane, the first Ryanair flight, where people could buy and book tickets. Funnily enough, it was west of Ireland airport to Warsaw. I have no idea why they picked that route. I think it was the first one they built, but it just goes to show how people are experiencing, and each of them have their own currencies. Sorry, too.
Why?
Because they can. It's gamification. It's children are enjoying these worlds more now because children love playing games, but they can actually make their own worlds and games. So that allows them to use their creativity and their imagination more and more. And weirdly enough, like Minecraft and Roblox, whilst we all have sensitivities around it because we read the headlines and go, this is bad for humans, they're actually learning how to code without realizing it. And when you talk about the future of AI, when you talk about the future technology and the future jobs, these children are learning to be software engineers before they're even breaking into their latter teens, which is mind-blowing.
I agree. Again, you're nodding away in agreement.
I agree. Yeah, it's no longer this job that you have to, I suppose it's not going to be a job to the point of jobs changing. Mm-hmm. Software engineering is not going to be a job where you study for a very, very long time and, you know, have to amass this body of knowledge to do, because you've got things like Roblox that teach the basics.
And AI, which will help you build most of what you've been trying to build manually or true coding for years.
Tarek, I want to come back to retailing though, because one of the criticisms that has often been made of SMEs in Ireland, retailers in particular, is that they have failed to embrace the internet for selling their goods. And if they fail to embrace the internet, are they going to embrace the AI opportunities available to them?
So I was actually talking to a retailer. I was going in to buy something from my baby, and they don't want an online store anymore. And their whole point is that they want people to have an experience, and that's how they create a connection with people. And I suppose that's where I think the importance of these Roblox communities and actually they enable you to have an experience with the store.
Sorry, Ty. I don't understand how you can say that retailers don't want to have an online store, because isn't the reality that for many consumers and purchasers now, they only buy online, yep, or they buy a large amount. They might occasionally walk into a shop to have a look, yep, and go and then purchase online.
The margins are very difficult though. For a small retailer, the e-commerce thing is very difficult.
Yeah.
I think it's fair to say. And the market is kind of saturated with big brands who have the economies of scale, who can make money. So I can understand why retailers in some cases are finding e-commerce difficult. But just, I think a lot of what's happening, like the kind of businesses that are emerging, Matt, I think there's different opportunities that are being created for all of us. You know, like Shopbox, if it's your repair client, you couldn't have predicted that kind of opportunity for business like ours and for businesses like AIB, you know, 10 years ago. So I think the old world economy, bricks and mortar retail, that would just have to change in some way. But the opportunities that get created on the back of it are huge for all of us.
There's definitely a lot to unpack in that as well, because like when you think of a small business, like depending on their size, time is so much so valuable to them, and building digital real estate is time consuming. So it depends on the category and product too. So making that decision to be less active there, yes, have a presence, but not retail, that might be the best decision, because it depends whether the product is something that you're making yourself physically or somebody else is making for you. That dictates where you even start to promote, market, you know, and scale. It's challenging. But just one thing to build from our experience too is that because now digital and social and content is so overwhelming and so saturated, people are looking to take a step back to real world experiences because it actually breaks you from the crowd and gives you a point of difference. And when it comes to trying to win in such competitive spaces like retail, everyone's seeking point of difference, whether it's technology or whether it's actually, do you know what? We're actually going to make a statement and stand to not do this. And that actually makes it interesting for people to actually grab attention and go, oh, maybe I will go, maybe I will try, because you're trying to do something different and emotionally connect with people.
Do you think the sort of content that gets created then from something like ChatGPT is good enough to help a brand to stand out from the crowd?
No. If you use it to the point of just putting in a prompt and using what comes in, it's going to do what a lot of people are doing already with limited resource. It's just going to make more vanilla corporate bullshit content. Mm. The people who get creative with it, that's who are going to have a bigger edge.
So it's only an assistant, right?
Yes. And it should be only an assistant. And it will get better over time. The tools will keep evolving. But in most forms of even marketing and communications, what you have to try and do is actually connect with people, either grab their attention and emotionally make them feel something in order to actually make a decision whether they might choose you or not. And that can't be done by boring content. It's what is the right word for this? It's weaponizing, which is a bad word. It's weaponizing library content and making it more vanilla, unless you know how to creatively flex it. And that's where the time freed up on that is probably going to make it better, providing you have the time.
But that's going to create new jobs too, right? Because people are going to have to learn skills. Like, so how you prompt ChatGPT has a massive impact.
Prompts are everything. There will be businesses who, it's almost like copywriting. It's almost like journalism. The people who can write amazing, clever prompts are people who are going to be able to use the tools better.
Yeah.
You know, because even like, I'll give you an example. If you do use ChatGPT and you do put in an initial prompt, you get back, again, a first draft. But you can actually ask them to actually now write me a prompt to make this better, and they'll give you back a better prompt. Once you know how to actually use the tools, it will be stronger, providing you can use the tools correctly.
Jane, I want to bring you in, because on something that Tariq said earlier about what Shopbox AI does is try to help smaller and medium-sized retailers in an environment where the likes of Amazon dominate. Mm-hmm. But would you be fearful that for a lot of smaller and medium-sized Irish businesses, that they will get swamped by the ability of the big giants like Amazon to put the resources into AI, which allow them to dominate the markets further?
Look, I think it's a concern that's been in existence for a long time for probably small businesses in Ireland and all across the globe. I personally think we're probably going to enter a period where AI and AI tooling is kind of increasingly commoditized, and hopefully that means kind of less expensive for people to implement AI into their business. I don't think we're quite there yet. Will the big companies always have an edge? Yes, but I think that's not a new thing with AI. That's something that's been around for a very long time.
In some ways, Matt, though, these tools probably make it easier for smaller companies like us to compete? You know, it's allowing you to compete with large companies, because you don't need the resource to produce the sort of content you need to produce, and you can get out to the market quicker, you're more nimble, you can experiment more. So in some ways, it could be an accelerant for small companies like ours.
That's and for me personally, it is, because as a consultant, my time is my money. And if I can find ways throughout my entire process or operation to free up more of my time, well, that's more time I can spend with clients and partners, which means I earn more money. And there's probably different examples of that across everybody in the room. The Amazon one is an interesting one too, because we're only surviving off .co.uk right now. Amazon.ee is coming, and it's going to be a bigger challenge in the Irish market too, to be more competitive too. So there might be a need for a lot of people to really consider, actually, when in doubt, join the crowd and actually set up a business platform within Amazon.ie to actually try and monetize. Yes, you might get a margin taken away, but it's going to be competitive.
I think there really is an education piece that's happening at the moment. Like, how it's evolved over the last 5 years is actually scary. I kind of fear for the generation coming behind us, what's going to change. But that education piece is really important, because you also have to kind of explain to them how you're trying to do things and kind of build these AI models. They're not like these black boxes anymore. And they can't be black boxes, as I think Brona talked about, and I think they have to be explainable. So for us, like, we're also building a lot of business logic into our models to help different retailers at different aspects of it. But also the education piece is one of the most challenging parts as well, because we'll often talk to retailers that are used to merchandising everything themselves manually, which is fine to maybe have like 500 products, but it still eats up a lot of your time. But when you have 200,000 or 60 million products, it's not possible. And then they still try to tweak things. They're, like we often get asked, can you do price restriction? So if someone's looking at a product that's 20 euro, don't show them anything less than 20 euro. And we've tested this actually on retailers, and it's actually counterintuitive, because what you're actually happening there, if I go look at a jumper that's 70 euro on a store, that might be the top of my price range. And with the models we built are understanding the user and their price points. So we might go, right, the best thing for them is to show them something similar, but that's 50. So if you had your price strict on there, they wouldn't have got that and you wouldn't have had a customer. Same is true the other way. You need to understand the customer that they'll actually go to the other end as well, that they'll pay more for a better product. So I think there's a huge education piece, and the AI kind of thing is, it's very exciting, but it's evolving very quickly for everyone, and it's difficult, I think.
Okay, I'm going to throw it out to the audience questions. Paul, I think we get a microphone to you. Hold on a second. Actually, while we're getting the microphone to you, just I want to ask, actually, Igor, your business is for hospitality at present. Yeah. Can you see it been expanded into other areas?
Perhaps. So the way we look at it is really starting with the problem. And wherever, one interesting thing that we've discovered in the last few years, growing Nori, is that whether it's two or three restaurants in the company or a few hundred restaurants, the problems on the ground are the same. It's consistency, it's margins. And that only is exacerbated then by scale, right? So I suppose if there are staffing and inventory problems in other industries, perhaps, right? If there's enough evidence for us to go into. And there's also something related to the conversation just a moment ago, from a product designer, tool builder type of perspective, right? The difficulty of, for Irish businesses, of getting going online and setting up, I suppose, can be mitigated by good product design, I think. One of the mistakes that I've made this mistake in my career is think that the tool I'm working on is my user's core focus throughout the day. It's not, or it depends on the persona. Perhaps for an operations director, trawling through data and getting insights is their core job. And therefore, you know, they're going to spend hours in the tool. But if we're talking about a user, a small business type of user who just wants to get set up and get going, they want to spend as little time as possible in the tool. So a completely different
And demo. Just for what you're doing at present in hospitality, are you selling this product outside of Ireland?
Yes, in the UK, the GCC, a couple of Western European countries as well. We also have customers who took us expanding from the UK to the US.
And what sort of competition are you facing? How many others are trying to do what you're doing?
So in terms of competition, there are two segments, I suppose. There are solutions that do all-in-one restaurant management. So they look after workforce inventory management and offer some degree of reporting. Their solutions built a very, very long time ago. Their solutions that we hear from our now customers haven't released an update to their software in years. And they definitely don't have that kind of insight capability that we're building out. On the other hand, in that other segment, are what we call point solutions. So that could be something you just mentioned, a scheduling tool that works for hospitality, but also works for hospitals and retail and a couple of other industries, but they only do scheduling, right? Same for inventory management, same for other core jobs to be done in a hospitality setting. For us, it's a feature of the operating system we're building. For others, it may be a whole product.
I'm going to ask people as they ask questions to maybe just identify themselves, where they're from, just for the purposes of the podcast. As it happens, I know the gentleman who is going to ask the next question, but for the purposes of the podcast, please introduce yourself.
And I probably don't need a microphone. Thanks, Matt. My name is Paul Hayes from BeachUp PR. We work with a lot of deep tech technologies. We've been working in the space for about 2 or 3 years now.
I had a client create an agent for me, financial agent. So it's dealing with AIB. And it's dealing with, you know, indices for my pension, God help it. So two questions. Are we entering, and I'm not allowed to have the remote to the telly in my house. I am not in any way. I'm quite proud of being a Luddite. And yet I now have an agent working for me, an AI agent, and I'll probably have one for my doctors and I'll have one for my, you know, whatever else middle-aged men obsess about. So I have two questions. Are we entering a low-code or no-code environment, which I find quite exciting because I've had to deal with you nerds for 25 or 30 years. And the other one then from an enterprise level, you know, because my agent is now talking to AIB. I don't know what they're talking about. They're probably having a great time. What are enterprises going to do to be able to talk to everyone's agents when that's a defensive moat and around it? And the low-code or no code thing is interesting to me as to how quickly that happens.
Sorry, what's no code, no code?
Well, like I built an agent and I literally don't know how I did it. I asked Claude, as it turns out, to just build me one because they were, you know, a thing.
Mike, you explain
I'm
that.
I'm not. You've got product people here. I know the basics, but let the experts.
I'll take a quick, a short answer on this. Is that I think you're kind of entering both in one regard. I don't think you're going to have, at the moment anyway, it's not going to be no code completely for everything. Yes, coders are still very important, but I think what you'll actually see is the developers that are going to advance and improve in their career, the ones that can explain things in plain English, which then automatically aligns itself to being nearly no code. So being able to explain stuff in plain English, like using the Claude, it can help you to build stuff, but only if you're very clear in terms of what you're trying to achieve. So I think product people are very well placed for this, that they're able to, because they can speak commercial and a little bit technical, they're able to use these no-code things to actually maybe build prototypes very quickly. So I think we're kind of, it's a bit of both in different situations, but certainly no-code is coming very quickly for certain aspects. So.
Jane?
Yeah, look, just to answer the kind of second part of the question around the enterprise engagement, I think, you know, it's amazing that you have an agent engaging with AIB. I think from our perspective, the human oversight element is going to remain really, really important. And I presume everyone as our potential customers or customers would want that assurance that we are overseeing the way we engage with you. We are overseeing, you know, the decisions, the transactions, to ensure that, you know, it's safe and ethical and trustworthy for our customers. So, you know, I think that human oversight is going to stay central for us on this side. But I think AI can support us in being more efficient in our response to you, being more personalized in our response to you. And that's where I see us playing.
Okay, do we have more questions from the audience, please? Yep, we have a lady here. Thank you very much. If you could just tell us your name, please.
Hi, Darina from Microsoft. My question has kind of two parts. It's specifically your perspectives on dealing with small to medium businesses. What's the biggest challenge for them adopting AI? Is it digital literacy or scaling, or is it data management? And if it's the latter, you know, what would your recommendations be, you know, to start that process?
Stuart, do you want to take that?
I think from our perspective and the perspective of our clients, there's a huge amount of noise. So trying to untangle the noise from the actual use case is probably quite difficult. And I thought the series was great for helping us to understand that, definitely in our business. So I think the first challenge is to really understand what applicability actually exists in the applications that are out there and how they could be used in our business. And I think secondly, and Brona touched on it, there's a concern, I guess, amongst business owners about the shadow use of AI and what that means in the context of the AI Act. And I think understanding what usage might be happening in the business that isn't necessarily coming from the top, that people are just using to augment and to improve the quality of what they're trying to do, and understanding any impact that may have. Like, it feels, I think, that this AI Act could be like GDPR on steroids. And it is a bit concerning that a team member with the best of intentions could do something using an AI tool that could put the business at risk. So I think that's a big concern. And I think there's just a huge amount, I think maybe Michael made the point, there's a huge amount of learning and development. Even this piece around the prompt, how do you, like, prompting
ChatGPT wasn't a job 18 months ago. So what upskilling do people in our businesses need to have to be able to make the best of the use of the tools that actually have a use case in our business?
Michael.
And it's probably a bit of evolution too. Most people here, if you are a small business, have been used to local enterprise and Leo partnerships and all these sub kind of benefits they give around there. Now is the time for them to be looking at this, because again, most startups or new businesses would have got their digital grant from the Leo enterprise or Leo partnerships. I think they all have them. But they probably need to start the AI conversation now and actually evolve those. Most of those partnerships are to help with digital marketing, building of a website, where more than likely most of those tools are already automated and made even easier to teach people to do that for a fraction of the cost of what the grant has been provided. And they probably need to look at actually how to educate on how to be more lean or efficient and smarter using AI to actually operate your business. So there's probably work need to be done there now, immediately, in order to get people ahead or even up to a basic level of knowledge.
Jane?
No, I just think the data management point is a really critical one. I think obviously everyone in this room will have heard garbage in, garbage out, but I think getting your data right before attempting to implement anything from an AI perspective is just essential. It's a journey and it's effort, but it's a worthwhile journey from my perspective.
Richard, second gentleman here.
Thanks very much. Nuala Keneally from Privacy Engine. And just the question is, do you find the biggest restrictions to adoption implementation are internal or external, like due to fear or lack of risk awareness, due to lack of competency? I believe like GDPR and the AI Act, if implemented correctly, can be enablers, help you collect more data, keep for longer and process it better. So like the demographics, which are clients or the people in your organization, where do you think the lack of awareness or the greater risk adversity is there?
Yeah, look, I think there's a huge education piece for everyone. And I think building that kind of foundational knowledge and that AI literacy is really important. I do think, to your point, the AI Act could actually support this. So back to Brona's point of building an AI inventory and understanding and mapping and measuring how AI is used all across your organization also leads to the potential to understand, this part of the business is utilizing AI for this strategic initiative. And actually that has scale play across lots of other parts of the business and could benefit them. So there's twofold. I think it's not intended to stifle innovation. It's intended to put safeguards around it, which is something we should all be thinking about anyway.
Anyone else in the panel want to respond to that?
They just should have called it something else than AI, because we look throughout history and how we've associated the letters of AI together, it has been built upon language of fear, aliens, artificial intelligence and scariness. We probably should have called it something a bit more warmer so people could embrace it more.
A bit late now, maybe though. Stuart?
I think to answer the question as it relates to our business, I think our people are very open to using the tools and are probably ahead of us in lots of ways. I think at a management level, we're trying to get our head around what we should be using and what we shouldn't be using. So maybe the restriction in our business is the understanding and the learning at the top of the business and trying to cascade that through. I'd be interested to hear what Michael would have called AI though.
Oh, I have no idea. Even ET sounds a bit more friendlier than AI. So,
okay, fourth row there, please.
Hi, I'm Maureen Rabbit from Galvia AI, and our CEO is actually one of your first speakers on the AI Magnified podcast. My question is, it goes with 2 weeks out from the election. I just wonder if any of the panelists have any opinion on whether Ireland is investing enough in AI. I know, Michael, you kind of touched on it there in the last answer.
The easiest is probably no, because it's going to transform businesses. It's a no-brainer. They should be doubling down. Obviously, there's a lot of data and all the areas where these people will be far more experienced than me. But yes, it needs to happen. It's going to make education easier, healthcare easier, operations and work easier. It's going to transform how we live. So we should be getting ahead. And even when we think about the challenges this country will have when it comes to changing of corporate tax, multinationals, making this place more attractive for these businesses to set up and operate here, we need to get ahead like we did when it came to the digital space 10, 15 years ago.
I must check the various political party manifestos to see just how many mentions they make of having an AI policy, as I suspect it's quite limited.
How many teachers are qualified in AI?
Stop. You left, Ryanair. Leave it alone, will you? Leave it alone. Okay, another question there in the third row there.
Hi, my name's Bevan Dunn. I'm from the CFO Centre. 9 days in, we've only started, but I'm around a long time. Actually, following on now from the education thing, I was at my son's sixth year parent-teacher meeting on Tuesday night. And actually, two of his teachers were telling me that they're using ChatGPT. I was kind of going, what? I couldn't believe it.
But up yours, Michael O'Leary.
well, and actually, the English teacher said that the kids are using it for King Lear, for the quotes. And she said, in actual fact, the information that they're putting in is incorrect. So she's explaining to them how to ask the question correctly to ChatGPT to get the quotes back out that relate to each of the themes in King Lear. And it came up in another subject, which I can't remember. But anyway, I thought it was an interesting observation, and perhaps it is something that should be brought into the schools at this stage, because he's going to college next year, hopefully. So he's the next generation coming up behind you guys. So anyway, there you go.
No, thank you for that. It is a very valid point, and I have my own experience with a fifth year secondary school son who's in doing something similar, using for essays and whatever, making sure that he does it all correctly rather than just lifting the material. Okay. Your question, please.
Hi, Jean Kelly from Brown Jacobson in Dublin. So we're a law firm for our sins, but humans, I like to say too. Quick question just on AI Act compliance. A lot of conversations around it, around deploying AI solutions and products. It's really a question, I think, for Stuart as much as anybody else in the panel, but I'd welcome other views. Are you seeing it becoming evaluation issues for companies who are selling AI products, that they're out ahead of AI Act, and because the customers that they're going to be buying or selling to, like the AIBs and Microsofts of this world, are going to look for warranties and indemnities on compliance. So it's kind of boring lawyer stuff, but those big companies are wide awake to this. Are you seeing it going to be a valuation or a sale issue for companies which are selling those products and services if you're a young company?
It's a great question. And 100% it has to be, right? I mean, it has to come into the consideration when an asset is being purchased or sold. And it's probably going to be a huge regulatory piece that the solicitors and the commercial lawyers are going to have to get their heads around. So, but I absolutely feel that it's going to be a material element of a diligence process and of an M&A transaction. Would you agree?
Yeah, so assuming because they're a smaller entity, that the bigger company will take the risk, the opposite is the case. The bigger company usually...
As is always the case.
As always the case, so there's a lot of ideas in AI. I think there's something to try to check with ahead of that, to be realistic to people that are starting to inject a bit of fairness into what is an imbalance sometimes in power. So, yeah, thank you.
Okay, Jane, do you want to come in on that?
Yeah, no, I think it could be a real point of differentiation for some of these companies, to be honest, to get ahead of this, because I think it is a question we ask almost immediately, and for us, if we're using third parties for AI, then we have to have that assurance, because how do we attest to the regulator otherwise? So...
Okay, Lawrence, you want to ask? Oh, sorry, somebody else just grabbed the microphone. Mind you, we've got
you in a second. My name is Damon. Okay. I'm from Fitzgerald Power. I work with Stuart, and I can see him sweating there now, saying, "What's he going to ask me?" But it's a don't worry, is that too bad? There was no drink back there. It's a two-parter, and it could be very long or it could be very concise. But what do you see is the biggest advantage to AI for your business, and what is the biggest potential danger?
Is that for me, Damon?
I'm always asking you questions. You can go first.
I'll go one word. Time.
Yeah.
So I would agree with that. I think the efficiencies that can come. Back to Michael's original point, though. It'll bring efficiencies in the mundane tasks, but it still requires human insight to actually make it work. So I think time... I can't remember the second part of your question,
Damon.
The danger. I suppose relying on something that gets produced by an artificial intelligence agent that hasn't been fully vetted by an expert human, that would be the biggest risk for our business.
Vetting is quite interesting on that as well. But again, when you think of the process, it might build it quicker, but you can fix bugs faster. So when you think of, again, time to build something versus letting a machine build it first and then fix the bugs, there's still a payoff there potentially. But verification and validation and some sort of, you know, guaranteed approval that this meets a standard, that's definitely an interesting space to try and make this more safer and trusted.
It feels that way, doesn't it?
Mm.
I think for us, it's definitely efficiency. Like for when you're starting a coding problem, I think, and this is, or just anything you're trying to build, I think just getting started is one of the biggest issues. And I find the tools out there for AI actually really just help you get started. So you're trying to write an email, it just helps you get going. But there is, it is prone to hallucinations. And this is a big thing that we have to be really careful with. Like at one point we were using some models to try to kind of build up better descriptions on products and stuff like that. Sure, was making up loads of stuff. And if you didn't validate it, you could have put out completely misinformation. So it's misinformation is obviously a big word with social media and stuff like that. So it is a real problem. That's probably the biggest danger I see with it.
Damien is prone to hallucinations as well. So it's not exclusive to AI.
It's a point I think I made during the series, but I've ended up at times recently arguing with ChatGPT, knowing that it's given me the wrong information and getting back in and saying, no, you're wrong. You need to dig deeper, and then getting it to apologize and coming back with the correct information. Lauren, super question from series or from the second episode, Lawrence.
Morning, Matt, and thank you to the panel. A lot of the conversation with AI probably starts with efficiency, which is a natural enough place to start. I think longer term, the real value is going to be on where companies can start to bring new offers to their clients. So we touched a little bit on it, I think, with what Tarek has spoken about in terms of your retail front and, you know, tailoring it and so on. I guess maybe I might direct it to Jane, but I think the entire panel would maybe have a view on it. A lot of the application, and certainly in banking, it's around fraud, which is important. It's around processing applications, which is important. It's around decisioning, which is important. But talk to any business person over the years, particularly going back maybe a generation, they were always spoken about the bank manager made a personal vote of confidence. So I suppose my challenge, and I think the real value longer term, is going to be where businesses can get sufficient insights into their clients and their potential clients to make offers. I'm interested to hear what the panel's view is on that.
Yeah, so I completely agree. I think everyone naturally goes to the efficiency space, but I think there's huge potential for personalization and greater personalization for our customers. So understanding what they want to see, when they want to see it, servicing them in the way they want to be serviced, and gaining that insight. And look, I think we do that to some extent today with our propensity modeling, but actually this allows us to do it in a much more powerful way. I think relationship managers will always be important for that, as you say, vote of confidence and that engagement. And that comes back to my human oversight point from earlier. I don't ever see a scenario where that, you know, personal touch and that human engagement won't exist. I think it's going to remain crucial, but, you know, we can maybe help you understand more about the sector or the industry you're in and support your business to a greater extent in that way.
I'm conscious of time. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to ask each panelist, maybe just to give a little summation at the end of what they think, having had the conversation that we've had, just maybe a closing point from each of you that you think that people in the audience can go away with here, the live audience, and also people listening to the podcast. Michael, I'll let you go first.
I think for me, it's to break down each stage of the business or the product that you're offering over the next 6 to 12 months. I would then study that area and search the tools that you feel that you can try and experiment, see can it make your business product time easier, and work through that to the point of seeing how can you actually use AI to a better advantage to give you back time, evolve your product, make things better.
Igor?
Sure. I suppose for me, it's like AI is a tool, right? It's there to solve problems. Without a product design background shining again, without a clearly defined problem, there's no point grabbing the tool and trying to do work on it unless you're just playing, right? And be aware that the problem you've identified and validated and understood may not require AI to solve it.
Yeah, so similarly, I think take the time at the outset to really think about this strategically. I know it feels like it's coming at us in a really fast-paced way, but I think, you know, giving yourself a little bit of breathing space to think about your business and where AI can really solve problems for you or meet opportunities is the way to proceed. And build up a foundation of knowledge in your business. Talk to your partners, talk to your vendors, talk to, you know, other industry experts and build that foundation of knowledge and then step into it in a really strategic and measured way. Be my.
Tariq?
I think there's a huge kind of exciting opportunity with AI. But I think it has to be quite measured. So you can't just jump in and do everything all at once. You have to have a clear goal of what you're trying to achieve with it. And when you implement a tool, that there's a good outcome, you have to start small. If you just try to do the big bang AI project, you probably end up failing and then you'll ignore it. So it's starting small and building up proof points and anything you use, make sure it's actually adding value. And obviously be careful of it. It's still a growing area. So.
Last word to you, Stuart.
And I completely agree with Tariq. I'm an optimist. I think there's going to be huge opportunities. And I think we can either ride this wave of innovation or we're paddling against the tide. And I see nothing but opportunity for SMEs with this development.
Stuart, Tariq, Jane, Igor and Michael, thank you all very much for your participation today. A big thank you to all of you who attended here as well today. To those of you who are listening to the podcast, to this recording, thank you as well for being with us and taking the interest in it. And thank you to AIB for hosting today's event, but particularly to Fitzgerald Power for the sponsorship of a series that I have found absolutely fascinating. A little bit at times overwhelming, a little bit fearful of what might be changing, but realizing that it all has to be embraced. Because it is happening, whether we actually like it or not, we have to actually deal with it and get with it. So from that point of view, I think this has been a very, very worthwhile exercise. But thank you all very much for being with us. So that's the conclusion of our AI Magnified Plus series, which is adjacent to our usual Magnified interview series. We hope very much that you've enjoyed it, that you've got a lot more information about where AI is taking us, whatever you'll do with it. And I'd like to thank Fitzgerald Power again for their support in this endeavour. It has turned out to be a fantastic idea, a fantastic collaboration. And, you know, never know, we might do more of this type of thing again in the future. We have a new series of Magnified coming in the next few days, back to the sort of more standard interviews rather than a specific theme. But we hope very much that you'll enjoy that as well. So until the next time, from me, Matt Cooper, thank you for being with us.
AI Magnified, brought to you by Go Loud and proudly sponsored by Fitzgerald Power. Adding value always. FitzgeraldPower.ie.
Go Loud. Sounds better with us.